This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. I do so like to receive indications from listeners, questions or ideas or thoughts about what I might have talked about. And since for the last two times I've been able to do Petals and Prose, when I was talking about orchids, I received a couple of letters from listeners. The first is from a very dear friend of mine, Star Colebrook, and I had given her an orchid, and she writes, "The orchid and I are at the kitchen table, 5 a.m., feeling delicate and elegant together, though I'm in my nightgown and jacket with a hot pack on my neck. The orchid's magenta, maroon on white is one of those occurrences in nature that there are no words for, not splotches, not spots. The colors occur like ink stains, but not quite. And the purpley red also has hints of orange, especially on the little bent fangs at the ends of the jaw, with deeper maroon in the fuzzy tongue at the very back of the mouth." Well, I'm one of those poets Robert Bly disparages in his News of the Universe collection. He doesn't like poets who make wild nature into human likenesses. But it goes both ways, I think. Humans are wild in nature, and orchids are both wild and domesticated. I love thinking about the attributes we share. And she goes on to say, she remembers my having read from Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief, and remembers her list of orchids, among them ladies' tresses. My Mitch and I went in search of ladies' tresses last summer in a Mendon pasture with Brian Dixon and the Nature Conservancy to mark each flowering stem with orange stakes and record their location on GPS to keep them off the federal endangered list and protect them locally as local treasures. We were pursuing beautiful things in a not-so-terrible place, which could become one of those terrible places if not for people like Brian. The ladies' tresses could be equated with Orlean's ghost orchids if not for the want of those who love orchids enough to protect them. And I would have been like Orlean, forever wanting to see them, but only if I'd known of them and had not gone looking. Just knowing they are there is a gift. As she says, it's lovely to have one thing you will always want to see. There's value in that as well, because you can imagine they, or it, will always be there, never be lost. And the matter of common names as contrasted with Latin names arises here. Common names are troublesome because they aren't the same everywhere. And so the Latin names for flowers is helpful and most accurate. And that comes to play in a letter from a friend of mine in Guatemala. She actually had not heard the program on orchids, but she happened to write me about them. And she says that she went to a large local nursery and saw a gorgeous orchid there. I asked after an attendant for the name of it, and he told me it was called terrestrial orchid. I said, yes, I can see it's growing in soil and not on a tree, but what is its name? He looked at me as though I had two heads and said he would ask. The person he asked told me in English, its name is Chinese ground orchid. I told him the plant had to belong to a specific orchid family and had to have a Latin name. He said he would look it up on the internet. That, of course, would be fantastic. She says that sarcastically because she doesn't use the internet, and she wanted him to know the Latin name. Well, I'm moving from thoughts of orchids. Well, no, actually, I bought one for myself today, but I'm wanting to talk today about winter gardens. And this first quotation is from Elizabeth Lawrence. And if you have listened to my Petals and Prose all along, I did talk about a letter exchange between Elizabeth Lawrence and Catherine White of The New Yorker, and also the wife of E.B. White. And their correspondence was lengthy and long and wonderful, usually about flowers, and it has been published and is extremely interesting to read. So this is from Elizabeth Lawrence, who lived in North Carolina. Of course, Catherine White lived in the East, and they never met, but they wrote. So this is Elizabeth Lawrence. I never did care for fair-weather gardeners. Standing behind glass doors and looking out at the cold ground and leafless branches, they exclaim, "How beautiful this must be in spring." Well, how beautiful it is now, I want to cry. If a lavender wash were laid on the boles of pine trees and the pale trunks of oriental magnolias, on the purple bricks around the pool, the red earth, the amber gravel, the fawn-colored stone, drawing them all together in a series of related tones. How beautiful it is when the pattern of the garden becomes clear again, wherein no leaves blur the long straight line or gentle curve or the restful circle laid on the square, when levels are sharply defined and intervals between steps have the rhythm of falling water, when hidden nests are revealed, distant treetops unveiled, and lost vistas regained. Sweeter yet than dream of song of summer or spring or winter sometimes smiles. The season's beauty is in the quality of the sunlight, which is more luminous when it is less brilliant, and in the delicacy of shadows, which are paler and more precise across gravel walks. My garden seems more beautiful than at any other time. The essence of warmth and light is in this delicious sun that seeps into the spirit and penetrates the marrow. At no other season is the sun so grateful, so gentle, and so healing. And then she goes on to say later, talking about British gardens, in Great Britain, people have always wanted to be out of doors, whether the weather is fine or not fine, and they have planted for all seasons. For his winter walks, Bacon, like formal alleys of evergreens, finely graveled and no grass because of the wet. Wordsworth's garden was a sheltered spot surrounded by informal groups of trees and shrubs, chosen for their attractiveness in winter. And in all seasons, Jane Austen's heroines wandered in the shrubbery. When I read about English gardens of the past, I think of their owners as still in them, seeking out an out-of-season primrose, watching for the first snowdrop. I think of Miss Jekyll at Munstead Wood, clumping along in her heavy boots. And some of you may remember my having talked about Gertrude Jekyll, the famous landscape architect in England. But the mention of Wordsworth's garden, I remembered some quite famous words of Wordsworth about gardens. Though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. And I looked back at Catherine White's writing, found a note she had written when she talked about one of her pleasures for winter gardens is winter reading and winter daydreams of what might be. The gardens of the mind are as rewarding a part of gardening as the partial successes of a good summer bloom. A lot of us don't have enough land, perhaps, to think of patterns and extensions, but even in a very small garden, to think beyond just putting in some petunias without thinking of form and the arrangement probably gives us less of beauty than we might have. Another book that I've enjoyed reading in is called The Morville Hours by Catherine Swift, and she too considers winter gardens. She says, "I still love the garden best in monochrome, in snow, in moonlight, in frost, in heavy dew, in fog, especially in freezing fog, when whole trees are drowned fathoms deep in Arctic air and the boundaries between sky and ground blur, when the silvered paths of the garden seem to float over the black earth of the empty beds like slender bridges, cantilevered over a chasm, and twigs and branches are transformed by the hoarfrost into fragile constructions of ice and air, each day a little longer, growing in the direction in which the air is flowing, like finger posts to the far north. My garden was conceived in winter, a garden of ruler straight lines and precise measurements of black ink and white paper, moonlight and shadows, the plan of a city which did not exist. A map of a place not yet discovered." The last book about winter pleasures talks about something that I like to do in late winter or early spring, and that is forcing branches into bloom so that I can bring them in the house and have spring a little earlier than it would be outside. This is from Our Life in Gardens by Joe Eck and Wayne Winterwood, and they say, in the middle of January, almost always, there comes a brief period of mild days so predictable from year to year that it has a name like any other season, the January thaw. Those days are a tease, really, for the cruelty of February still lies before us, and even March can go out like the lion it came in as. But for the few days, rain might fall, snows melt, and every night temperatures hover around 20. Here in Vermont, January thaw does not hurry winter along, for we must still be enthralled to it for 2 or even 3 months. They go on to talk about this, but I'll tell you briefly what I do when I force branches. Pussy willows, all of the willows are easy to force. Forsythia works well. And essentially, I just cut back the bark a little bit, an inch and a half or two, put them in warm water in a dark place for about a week, and then bring them into the sun, and they will go into blossom. So when you're bone weary of winter and can't wait for spring, this is the time to force such spring blossoms into bloom. When you force branches into bloom about a month or two before they would bloom normally, you enjoy spring ahead of time. So bundle up, go out in the yard, and cut some branches from your dormant flowering shrubs and trees. I hope that you might have the pleasure of doing this. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.